Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 2 of the Off the Table Global Surgery Podcast. My name is Emily, and today, Amuna and I are excited to interview Dr. Marcella Ryan Cocker, a physician from Sierra Leone, a global health enthusiast, an aspiring orthopedic surgeon, and an inspirational feminist. Welcome, Marcella.
Thank you, Emily.
Could you tell us a little bit about you, where you grew up, what made you decide to become a surgeon, and what you like about this profession?
So I am Marcella. I was born and raised in Sierra Leone. I have pretty much lived here all of my life, except for 1 year when I went to the UK to do a master's degree. So usually when they ask me why I decided to become a surgeon or why I like this profession, I like to tell the story of how I am not one of those people who knew from very early on that they wanted to do surgery. I literally went into med school because it was one of two things that you could do when you're in the sciences. So you can either do medicine or engineering. That's like the well-paid or well-respected job. So I chose medicine. But then along the way, I finished and then I started my internship. And then I realized that I really liked surgery. The first time that I went to the theater, my boss let me observe this surgery with skin grafts. And I found it really, really amusing. And then I would say that it was in that moment that I knew that I wanted to do this because I found it really interesting. And I like surgery because it kind of let me use my hands. I like to use my hands a lot. I like to do all this DIY stuff. So Surgery lets me do that. So it's like art and science and it's really beautiful. I like to see the patients walk home. I like to see the results almost immediately. I find it very fulfilling.
So you're from Sierra Leone, where there's only one medical school. Can you tell us about the challenges of medical and surgical training in Sierra Leone and sub-Saharan Africa in general?
I would say, okay, I agree that medicine in every part of the world is intense, but I will say the training here is really, really tedious. And we don't have another choice. So if you want to do medicine, then you have to suck it up. One of the things that I found really difficult was that we didn't do a lot of practical stuff. We did more theories. So going into the real world and working in hospitals, it was a bit of a struggle in the beginning when I just started working, because the way the training is structured in med school is it's more books and more reading stuff than actual using your hands. And also med school is really expensive. I know it's expensive everywhere in the world, but considering that a lot of people here are poor and they don't have so much money to live below minimum wage and these things, it's really a struggle if you don't have a scholarship. And with the surgical training, I would say one of the things that I find very challenging is this, that we don't have like a very smooth, clear pathway for progression. Now we have the new postgraduate college. So it's starting to take some shape or form, but before we didn't, and that's very exhausting as well. And the hospitals are not so equipped. So also that is a challenge.
I hear that, Marcella. It's interesting to hear that there's some progress, though. And can you tell us a little bit more for those of us who don't know about the nitty-gritty stuff about surgical training in sub-Saharan Africa, what that postgraduate college is and how it functions in terms of surgical training?
So the postgraduate college is basically like a local college that supports the training. So you get to do the training in country rather than going out of the country, because before we had no local formal training program. So this postgraduate college gives that opportunity for people to be trained in country. So you take the exams and then you start the training in Sierra Leone. You don't have to move away from the country. I think it's similar like in other West African countries, Ghana, Nigeria, and these places. They all have similar training programs.
Well, that's really good to hear that that's gotten to that level. Do you know how many surgeons have been able to graduate since that was implemented?
It literally just got implemented this year.
Amazing.
We just got started.
You're going to be one of the first graduates.
Hopefully.
Yes, we're all rooting for you.
Thank you, Emily.
I want to talk a little bit about the healthcare system in your country. I know you mentioned it a lot in your blogs. Noticed that you've actually right now work for the NGO Emergency. Can you tell us a little bit how the infrastructure and the caregiving to patient compares between that NGO, for example, and the Ministry of Health hospitals in Sierra Leone?
So in terms of patient care, I would talk more on like emergency care. So the other public hospitals, a lot of them struggle with providing emergency care for patients, whereas at emergency, there is some structure, there are facilities available to provide quality emergency care for the patient. Say, for example, some of the public hospitals, they don't have basic things like enough oxygen supply or enough emergency medications, and they are not free. Even if these are available, medications are not free, they have to be paid for. So if you have a situation where the patient comes in, they don't have money or something like that, it's going to be a struggle for them to get emergency care. What emergency hospital does is provide this care free of charge. So you would see how the service would be different and how the burden of patient that comes to emergency would be more, because it's free and they know that they would get better care than they would in the public hospitals.
That's maybe a controversial question, but I figure if all this care, the emergency care, the care for trauma patients, for, you know, very sick patients, is provided for free by an international organization like Emergency, how does that keep the government accountable to actually deliver that care for their patients in country? And do you think actually this is impairing the local healthcare system, or it's actually helping? I'm just like, I feel a bit torn with this.
I totally get where you're coming from. I think it's a bit of both. So if you look at it one way, what would the people do if there was an emergency? Like if there wasn't this emergency trauma service available, what would happen to the people? Mm-hmm. Would people die? Would more people be disabled? What would be the situation? So in a way, they're really helping with that, taking off that burden from the local hospitals and the local government. But then in another way, I feel that we can also think that they are giving the public facilities the sort of like the leeway to not really push for these things. Because if emergency was not there, then for sure there would have been maybe some form of push to improve emergency services. So I think we can look at it in both ways. It's not so straightforward, not so black and white. So they're helping, but then I think because emergency is here, we're also a bit complacent with moving and pushing the other hospitals to do better, to provide this kind of care.
Of course, because now you're thinking, well, somebody else is doing it for me. Why would I put the effort into it? Yeah. I'm wondering, I don't know very, very much about this organization, but is it the type of NGO you think, from your perspective, that will stay forever? Or are they trying to, you know, set a period of time where eventually they're going to phase out and hand over their activities, their infrastructures, and maybe some resources to the local healthcare system, and be able to actually leave and leave something behind in terms of that type of care that they were providing.
I think in the long run, they would want to hand over the project. So I think the goal is to help and strengthen local capacity, help and train doctors, nurses, anesthesia technicians. So eventually they would phase out and hand over the project to the government.
I just have a follow-up question then about that, the training that you mentioned. How has your experience been with that NGO emergency in terms of training? I've seen on the website that they're a training school for nurse anesthetists. Are they doing a lot of teaching, training of other healthcare professionals? Like, what about you? Are they teaching physicians like you about surgery? Are you getting some education out of working with that organization?
Yes, they're actually a part of the University of Sierra Leone Teaching Hospital Complex. And Emergency Hospital is one of the accredited hospitals for training. So nurses and doctors and nurse anesthetists get trained there. I will say it's a really good training opportunity. Basically, all my experience in surgery has been from working there.
So just moving on to your academic journey, I was really fascinated by the journey that you've done for global surgery. In 2018, you did a Master of Global Health and Development at the University College London. And I read your post about it. I could really feel that the thrill and the excitement you felt through your written words. I know that it was extremely challenging. So could you tell us how that experience influenced your career plans?
I will say that that master's degree really did a lot for me.
My time at UCL really gave me some real direction. Like before I went to UCL, I knew that I loved surgery. I had interest in research. I loved knowing and learning about non-communicable diseases, but I didn't quite understand how I could merge all of these interests. My time at UCL gave me like a lot of exposure. I got a wider perspective. I got to understand more about global public health and global surgery and how intertwined all of these are. And then by the end of the year, I knew for sure what career paths I wanted to follow. I had ideas of how I wanted to contribute and give back to my country.
That's really amazing. I love that you got that inspiration. So your academic journey was only just kind of beginning, right? You also did a short course in global surgery, and you're also in a master's in surgical sciences at the University of Edinburgh. Can you tell us what your next move or next plan in your academic journey is going to be?
So I want to do a residency. I want to start my training in orthopedics and trauma. So that's like my plan for the immediate future. I would also like to do the global surgical care course at UBC. So I had to move that to next year because I still have to complete my ongoing master's at Edinburgh. But yeah, short term, that's what I would like to do.
Only that, only another master's and a residency in becoming an orthopedic trauma surgeon.
I would like to also do some research. I have been involved in some research in around gender equity, in trauma in sub-Saharan Africa. Long term, I would like to do a PhD in global surgery and focus my work on trauma in Sierra Leone. So those are like the plans that I have now, and obviously see how things go.
I almost could see this coming, the master's leading to a PhD. Can't stop you.
It was quite obvious, no.
We will go back to your gender equity research. I think we're both extremely interested by that, and being both women in healthcare, we really want to hear more about this, and we're very passionate about increasing the presence of women in this field. So we'll talk about that soon. But now I just finished talking about this master's concept and moving through your PhD and your career plans. I'm wondering, how do you feel about you know, the fact that all those graduate programs are hosted in high income countries, they're all in big universities like Harvard, like UBC, like University of Edinburgh, UCL. You know, they're, yes, geared towards global health and aim to like provide a better understanding of that field. But at the end of the day, the people we want to help are actually the people who work in the field in those lower resource settings. And I wonder how those programs, which are hosted outside of those lower resource settings, are helpful for people like you.
So from all the courses that I have done so far, a lot of them are hosted and taught in high-income countries, but I should say that a lot of contents are focused on low and middle-income countries. When I was doing my time at UCL, a lot of the lecturers and the professors had some experience in low and middle-income countries, so they gave a lot of examples and a lot of contextual stuff related to low and middle income countries. So even though I would love to see some of these courses and do some of these courses in low and middle income countries, it is not all so bad. It is not all focused on high income countries. Some things I don't find relevant to my settings, but some things are not. So I still find them quite useful. I gain a lot of knowledge. So I still find them very, very useful.
That's really great to hear, because I think for us at UBC, having this Master's of Global Surgical Care, we hope that we can actually give tools to people like you to actually be better advocates for surgical care in their countries. But we also are very conscious about being a little bit of part of the problem. Like I still feel like this is a little bit of a colonialistic approach for us to teach about things that are outside of our context and our environment. And so this is why I wanted your perspective on what's most useful in taking those types of courses, like what you get the most out of and what's not useful and what might be an approach that's more colonialistic.
So the things that I find most useful are things that are tailored to low and middle income settings, because I went to some lectures and all of the talks, they're supposed to be things that I could implement in Sierra Leone, but they were given like examples and settings from high income countries, which are not replicable and not feasible in a setting like Sierra Leone. So the things that I found more useful are things that allowed us to come up with ideas or some projects in our who actually know the field, who actually have worked there, to come up with ideas that are sustainable for them. I found those ones really, really helpful, because then it helped me to think outside of the box in like real life situations here in Sierra Leone. I totally get what you're saying about high income countries trying to tell you what to do in low income countries without a lot of experience in low income countries. So sometimes I had like a few back and forth conversations with some of my tutors about, okay, this could work in a high income setting, but in my setting, I know for sure that this wouldn't work. Like, you can have the ideas, but you need to have the context to be able to come up with sustainable solutions.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You need to have the context to find sustainable solutions. I really like what you just said there. Do you think, you know, ideally moving forward, like in the next 10, 15 years, that it would be people like you teaching those courses, not people like me?
It's my intention.
Okay.
I really teach in the future, mentoring and guidance.
Well, we're looking forward to that. And we hope we can, in the meanwhile, give you the tools to achieve that.
I hope so too. I'm looking forward to it.
So just to talk about something else, since you are a really strong advocate of the universal access to surgical care, I know that you're the leader of the Incision Sierra Leone Surgical Working Group. Could you just describe for me and for every other listener what Incision is, their vision, and how they help increase the awareness of surgical care?
So Incision is a group of young doctors and medical students from all across the world that have come together to build on advocacy and research and mentoring to push the agenda of global surgery. So we have different networking groups in different countries, and Sierra Leone is one of the national working groups. And our chapter is still quite young, and global surgery is still like a somewhat new concept in Sierra Leone. So most of the campaigns that we do are through social media. So we try to create posts and talk about global surgery and get a lot of young people and also like the middle carers aware about global surgery and the need for global surgery. Currently, we're putting together a surgical skills lab where we will get facilitators and surgery specialists to help train and teach medical students and interns basic surgical skills. So suturing, tying knot, practicing to give compressions, basic life support, attending to a trauma care patient. So just basic things that you really need to know to start working in surgery in our setting.
It's really nice to hear about what incident is. I just wanted to talk about the gender diversity in surgery. It's something that I'm also very passionate about as a woman in science. And I know that there's only currently one specialized female surgeon in Sierra Leone, which I learned from your post. Could you tell us a little bit more about the barriers to medical and surgical training that women face and what actions that you or we can take to close that gender gap?
In my experience, I would say first it has to do with dealing with the daily microaggressions. So like people thinking that you're less competent than your male colleagues or people or your colleagues trying to basically mansplain everything that you have just said, or people judging you by your appearance instead of your capabilities. So they see you and they see a pretty face instead of seeing a surgical care provider, or the patients referring to you as a nurse, even though you're wearing the same exact uniform as your male colleague. So it's sometimes dealing with all these microaggressions and sexist comments from the patients or from some coworkers that can be quite mentally exhausting sometimes. And they sort of like impact your confidence and your ability to see yourself as being capable. And also I would say with societal expectations, because in our settings, the African setting, a girl child is supposed to be a wife, be a mom at a certain age. So you saying that I want to be a surgeon comes with a lot of questioning, a lot of comments and concerns from parents, from just society in general. Everyone looks at you like, okay, this one doesn't want to get married, or this one doesn't want to have kids and things like that. So it's also a lot of pressure. And then when you do have kids or you do have a husband, it's very challenging to find like a work-life balance, if you get what I mean, like trying to be committed to the job, working long hours, because surgery is really, really demanding. So you don't want to seem or be perceived as not being totally committed, but also you want to be a part of your family's life. You want to be involved in things at home. So it's also a lot of pressure. And then if you want to go into specialty, it takes another 4, 5, 6, 7 years depending on what you want to specialize in. And then I would also say a lack of support and role models. For me I find it really, really I don't know if I could say comforting to see like a female surgeon who has done really, really well. It's very inspiring. It sort of pushes you to do better, to know in your head that it can be done. But then here we have just one female surgeon, so it's not so much, you don't get like a lot of mentoring from female surgeons. I find it like it would be easier if you had a woman to talk to about problems that you experience at work, gender-based problems, than talking to a man about it. So it's sometimes tough to deal with. I feel like to to close that gap or to sort of address some of these challenges, we first have to recognize and acknowledge that they exist. Because sometimes I find people saying that, it's not so true, it's not like that. We have to understand that these comments that people make or these microaggressions that we have to deal with, they are relevant, they are valid, and they can impact how you cope with the surgical training. And then it would be really, really great to get some sponsor, some mentorship in surgery, female mentors, female role models who we would look up to. And I think another thing that would be really amazing is to have like a proper maternity leave, because returning to work after you've had a baby, it can be quite a lot to take on. So I feel like some of these things can help make the situations better and achieve some equity in surgical practice and training.
You made a lot of great points, and I completely agree with you. I think women definitely need a lot more support from other women, just so that they have somebody to talk to. I would love that for the future as well.
Yeah, me too.
I think we're well, you know, it's a good start for the three of us to be on this on this call together. And I was going to say, Marcella, I've actually lived all the situations you mentioned. You know, I'm the only trauma surgeon, female trauma surgeon in my group right now. We're six of us. So nobody to look up to. Second of all, microaggressions, it's interesting. And I actually would like to have your take on that. And I've never really known how to respond to those because they're so subtle. They're subtle and sneaky, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, very recently, one of my senior male colleagues just looked down at my nails and said, oh, I've never seen such bright nails on a surgeon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What do you respond to that?
What would you say? Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know what I said? I said, you haven't seen my feet because they're bright yellow.
Amazing.
But
I give you a 10 over 10.
How is that important? How do I comment on your beard or, you know, the size of your nose?
It's really hard. I think it's something that they do almost unconsciously, and then we can't really comment on it either.
Yeah,
but that takes like away from, go ahead, Marcel.
I was going to say it's like a reflex response to just seeing you being a female in a surgical team. So they just say this thing. Sometimes I feel like they're not even aware that it's offensive. It's just sort of normal to them that they can say, oh, you have nail polish on, or your hands are girly hands, or some flimsy comments like that. And it's really unfair because, like you said, what would I say? Sometimes I'm really stunned and I don't know what to say. Sometimes I manage to give back some flimsy remarks or something, but sometimes by the time I wrap my head around what they just said, like the moment is gone.
Yeah, and then like 2 days later, you're like, oh, I should have said that. Yeah,
exactly. Like I come home and think like, oh, I should have said something, but that's gone now. But yeah.
But the other thing is like, the only way to always be ready to say something back is that you're always on the defensive. You're always ready to like fight back. And is this really how we want to live our lives? Like, I feel like we are professionals and we're all at the same level here. So why do we get to have to respond all day to comments like that and not talk about, you know, our profession and our specialty and you know, our work, and basically be at the same level as they are, because that's basically what it is. It's comments about who we are as a gender, not who we are as a physician or a nurse or a doctor or any other, you know, profession, I think would be applicable as well. I was interested.
Very unfair. It's very, very unfair. Like, it's not supposed to be like that. We're not supposed to be on the defense or defend ourselves or have to prove that we're just as good as them. But I guess the hope that we have is that one day we wouldn't have to do that and gender equity would have been achieved. But until then, we have to make our voices heard, I think.
I think we also have to find mentors and role models and leaders and people we look up to everywhere, across all disciplines, across all specialties, across all, you know, contexts and countries in the world. And I think that's partially why we want to do this type of conversations. We want to connect with people who lived similar situations, you know, I would love to be to have like a mentorship relationship with you. That'd be really great, because I think we can learn a lot from each other and then develop some tricks.
Like life-saving tips and tricks, yep, how to survive in trauma surgery would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
but I think mentorship is really important. Like it can make all the difference, really. It can make a lot of difference in how you approach surgical training, how you cope with the stresses of surgical training. It's really important.
I really love that you guys have the initiative to like fight back. A lot of people have told me that I should just like kind of take it, since they're just like microaggressions, as you said, and we just like laugh it off. And I hate that.
No, don't do that.
You enable them to keep doing it. And that's what's happening, is that they will keep thinking it's normal. And it, this is how normalized. They should see us. Exactly. Absolutely. You're right. But it's a lot of energy spent on defending yourself. And then the motherhood is a whole entire ball game. It's very rare to see male surgeons take paternity leave or take as much care of their children as female surgeons do. And I know that from experience in my practice. And it's hard, because you also want to be good at your job, but you also want to be good at home. And it's almost impossible to do it well in both spheres. And so you end up always feeling guilty and not appropriate at work and at home.
Yeah, I think so too. It's quite, I don't have kids, but I have friends who have kids, and I see the battle that they're in all the time. So you want to be committed, you want to be at the hospital and work these long hours and learn and progress in your training, but you also want to be in your kids' life. You also want to be at your family's events and get-togethers and all these things. So sometimes it can be a bit of a tussle. So it is why it's really essential that we have support, because how else are you going to find this balance without the kind of support that you need?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I'm glad you already have that network around you. It seems like you're doing all the right things to have a very strong career in surgery.
I'm trying.
Talking about action items, like I've read really recently that you had obtained ethics approval for a research project on the cultural barriers faced by women in surgery. Can you tell us a little bit more about that project?
Yeah, so that project is part of the Gender Equity Initiative in Global Surgery. I don't know if you guys have heard about this group. It's like an initiative that was born from the Harvard program for social change in global surgery. So what JETS do is basically like advocate kind of like incision, but more for gender equity. So that project about the cultural barriers, it's like my baby project. So everyone was given their ideas about projects, and I thought that it would be really nice to understand the barriers that women in Africa face, because a lot of these papers that have been written about barriers in surgical training have been focused in high-income countries. There's not like a lot of literature on these problems in low and middle income countries in Africa, especially. So what we're trying to do is to do this online survey that we would look at what barriers people face and how they think they can be supported. So what challenges they go through, how they deal with them, and what would be the way forward.
It's really cool. It seems to me like you're going to build a toolbox for us.
We're trying. That's the idea.
Do you know when this survey is going to be launched?
Hopefully in 2 months. We're trying to get it done, to start pushing it. Now we have the ethical approval. That took a while, but hopefully in the next few months, we should start rolling it out.
That's so cool. We're really looking forward to those results, and we'll share with all of our colleagues here, and I'm sure it could be helpful in our settings as well.
Just the next question is a bit of a hypothetical. If you had to choose one actionable item with a clear time-bound target and something that could advance the rural surgical care in your country, what would it be?
So trauma care is something that is really, really close to my heart. So what I would want to do or to see be done is primary trauma care training. So to try to decentralize surgical care, because what happens in Sierra Leone is that most of the facilities that provide surgical care are in the city, do not have access to surgical care. And so sometimes by the time they get to field and from some places, it's quite far. By the time they get here, it's late, there are complications. So what I would like to see is people and health workers in the provinces being able to manage and stabilize trauma patients before they refer them to the tertiary facilities in Freetown. I feel like that is something that is completely doable, because I have read a lot about it in other countries, South Africa and these places that have implemented primary trauma care trainings, and it will increase access to surgical care in the provinces.
I love that. You're speaking to my heart too. I'm a trauma surgeon, so I do believe that primary healthcare starts with trauma care. Nobody should die from an injury. Did you have any type of training in mind, any type of course or like kind of system of building trauma capacity in terms of empowering like healthcare providers who provide trauma care?
So I know that the AO Alliance is trying to start a training in non-fracture care management, and it's underway. I think it should be in November. So I was thinking that trainings like that could really, really get more capacity building, you know? So get more people to understand how to approach these patients and how to stabilize them, because then they send the patients without being properly stabilized. Their fractures are not properly immobilized. So it would be really great to get people to understand how to approach these patients in a systematic way before they are being sent to the tertiary centers.
That's really great. And maybe we can talk about this offline, but one of my colleagues here at Vancouver Regional Hospital also is has experience in doing some trauma team training. He's done some of those courses in Ethiopia, but I kind of like this course because it's all inclusive. We teach nurses, OR techs, general practitioners, like basically anybody in a healthcare system, even in a tiny like district hospital, that would be involved in taking care of a trauma patient would be able to take care of that amenable to take that course and to build that team to take care of the trauma patient, because as you and I both know, like it's never relying on a single provider. I think that'd be really cool too.
I think a model like that would work.
Last question, who would you recommend that we host next?
I would love to see Professor Salome Maswime. She is the head of global surgery at University of Cape Town. She is amazing. She is one of my biggest inspirations in global surgery, how she does all of this family work, advocacy, obstetrics. It's just really amazing to hear her story. So I would like you guys to host her. I would like to hear a story again. I've had it a couple of times, but it's always very refreshing to hear something new-ish.
So, I'd love to meet someone who inspired you.
You would love her.
We already do. We've actually been following her, and we wanted to invite her for a global surgery meeting that we want to host next year. So she's on our list. But that's amazing. Yay. Like, I like that it's, see, we're all connected. We all like the same people and look up to them. So we're going to create this badass group of, you know, surgeons and surgical providers across the world.
Yep, that's the goal.
Marcella, it was amazing to have you on the podcast today, and we hope we can all meet in person one day. That'd really be nice to actually have some human contact again.
Hopefully, not in the far, far future.
I just wanted to say thank you so much, Marcella. It was really nice to hear from you.
Thank you, Amuna. It was nice to be in the podcast too. I was really excited. I'm always very excited. All things global surgery.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat here.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_global surgery, and Twitter, offthetable_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.